Welcome to the Parentpreneur Accelerator Podcast, helping you build the business of your dreams while having time with the family you love. Here is your host, Cyril, the entrepreneur and proud dad, Alexis Kingsbury.
Thank you very much for your help, Ethan.
Hi there, it's Alexis here, and in this week's episode, I'm interviewing Tori Wagg. Tori is a chartered management accountant who qualified with CIMA in 2006. She grew up in Hampshire and studied philosophy, politics and economics at Pembroke College in Oxford. She then trained whilst working in industry for Nestlé Waters and for the University of Oxford, and went on to start Panthera Accounting a few months after having her first daughter, Melissa, back in 2006. Panthera has grown from a one-woman band to a team of eight across two offices. And Panthera is on a mission to help small business owners thrive and achieve their goals through the magic combination of great financial processes and a very caring support team. Tori lives in South Oxfordshire with her husband Jake, her daughters Melissa and Jasmine, three Labradors and one understandably very harassed cat. So in this episode, we're going to discuss why building a support team around you is essential, both in terms of your employees, your networks, your friendships, how to balance parenting with the demands of running a small business, and perhaps particularly touch on the finance aspects of that, and also the mental health demands on business owners, and which particularly as we happen to be recording this episode, around the time in the UK, people are doing self-assessed tax returns. Perhaps people's mental health isn't as great at this time of year than others, so it feels particularly appropriate. So Tori, thank you so much for joining me.
That's a pleasure. Thanks, Alexis, for having me on.
Great. Well, let's start off a bit about the creation of Panthera Accounting, what it does, and why you kind of started it after the birth of your first daughter.
Yeah, looking back, it seems like a really crazy time to decide to start up a business. But it was really because I've been working in Oxford, travelling in and out, heavily pregnant, doing that big commute that had become about, I don't know, a couple of hours of my day at least. And once I had a child at home, I suddenly thought that's time I could be spending with her, and I'm wasting it in the car. So it would be really nice to be able to work from home. That wasn't an option open to me from my employer at the time. And so I kind of felt super brave and thought, I'll just go and find some people that want me to do management accounting, but from home. And I was in a really lucky position that my dad was running a small management consulting firm at the time. And he said to me, I've got a little bit of work, maybe a day or two a week. Would you like to come down? My mum could look after Melissa for that day. I could get some work done and sort of keep my hand in the game. And that's really how the business started. And I went from doing a small amount of work alongside my dad to getting on my own clients and then building out to having a full-time job that way.
Fantastic. And so for a lot of people setting up a business like that, they end up staying as a kind of one-man band, or maybe themselves plus maybe an assistant. But in your case, you know, you've grown that team. So how did you build the business from just yourself to a team of now eight people?
So I think the first step was really when I was pregnant with my second daughter, Jasmine. So that was about 2.5 years later. I suddenly realized that I could either take a maternity break and stop looking after my clients and I'd have a big old hole in my business, or I had to recruit at that stage. So I pretty much straight as soon as I knew I was pregnant, went out and said, I need an assistant, and I brought in somebody to come and work with me at home in my little home office. So this wasn't in a serviced office or anything like that. We were just working from my small space at home. And I taught her over that period of time how to do the basics of what I was doing. So the basics of bookkeeping, how to keep the clients being looked after whilst I was I was meant to be on maternity leave. I managed 7 days off and then I went straight back into seeing clients with a buggy. But it meant that then I'd got the feel for having somebody else that I could delegate to. And from that point on, I thought that's the way to grow this business. I don't really just want a job. I want to have a business behind me. And so after that, I actually went about growing by acquiring businesses, which is a slightly different route to to one that other people have taken, I did build up my client base to a certain level. And then I went out and actually bought a practice that was for sale because the really sadly, the accountant that was running it at the time was very sick with cancer, but he had a couple of members of staff and he had nobody to look after them. So the family said, could you come and help just run that business on a 1 day a week basis? And sadly, he died and there was nobody to keep that going. So I bought the business from the family and grew in that way.
Wow. Wow. And so how many people did that then take you to? How many were you then at that point?
So I was five at that point. So I had I had an assistant, really. And then I also had a bookkeeper that was working on an ad hoc basis for me. And then I got two more members of staff from that acquisition. And then we moved premises because we couldn't all squeeze into the small spaces that we had. So that's when we really started to have Panthera as a what I think of as a classic high street accountant. So we had a high street premises, five members of staff all working together in the same space. And that's what really started to grow the business quite quickly.
Fantastic. And so at that point, you were still in one office together, the five of, is that five plus you at that point?
So no, that was five altogether.
Five including
and what
you.
Yeah, what we did at that stage is we moved out of my home office into an office here in Didcot, which is a town about 20 minutes from my house. Up until then, we'd sort of just been running from the front room of my house and doing meetings in the sitting room and that type of business. And so it started to feel a bit more grown up in that I could go to work and then I could come home from work, shut the door, and I was being a mum when I got home rather than doing that crazy juggle where you're trying to see clients but also trying to do your parenting and run a household at the same time.
Nice. And I, as you say, there's various benefits of doing that. Were there any problems or perhaps particularly unanticipated ones? Because I imagine the first one is that you've got some costs that you suddenly weren't used to having suddenly appear. But what other challenges did you find?
Oh, so many challenges. I think whenever you make that move from home to an office away from the space that you're living in, just the organization that you need to have going on. So you've got to get out of the house, you've got to make sure there's somebody to look after the kids, you've got to have some kind of process in place for what happens when somebody's sick at nursery and you've got to get back quickly. So all of those kind of things had to change. I was really, really lucky because my husband Jake is at home. He's a tutor by trade, so he tutors kids mostly doing A level for sciences. So he's always around during the day. So I didn't have too much of a problem with the childcare side. And we did bring in having au pairs at home as well. So we always had somebody in the house to help with that kind of side of things. Premises is always really tricky for us. So we've had struggles with landlords, we've had problems finding the right kind of space for what we need. And then adding in a cost base it's a big responsibility, you know, having to pay the rent at the end of each month, having to pay all these people as well. It goes from being able to be quite relaxed about, well, there's some money in the business bank and it's all mine, to this is a really serious business and we need to make sure we've got enough money all the time to pay the people and the places that we stay in. So those kind of changes in responsibility also take up a lot more of your time. So running the business became a lot more of my job than the doing of the accounting.
Absolutely. And so as you sort of grew up with that then business, what about in terms of, you know, going from one plus an assistant, going to five people, sort of management then becomes a thing that you suddenly have to do. How quickly did you kind of set up other processes for that? What do you what did you put in place and perhaps what's worked for you and continues to work now?
Yes, yeah, so I've never had any formal management training. I went from working for other people and I was only about 26 when I started up the business. So I didn't have that much experience of how to manage people, and I've learned through quite a lot of trial and error. I'm just being really open with the staff. So my view is always make sure everybody's really well included and people know what your plans are, so that when you're trying to grow a team, everybody's on the same page. And then once when you've got members of staff coming in, looking out for the signs that they're going to be great managers. So even people coming in right at the bottom of the team, as they've come up through the team, it's watching out for those people that I think can take on more responsibility and giving it to them, really allowing them to grow into the potential that they've got, and being open to the fact that there are definitely things that members of my staff can do a lot better than I can, management and leadership being some of that, and then allowing them to do that. So I've got one of the members of staff that joined us from the accounting firm that I bought. She's gone from being really an accounts assistant up to being my number two, and now manages my accounting team, and has really stepped up into that role and made it her own. And that's been really exciting to watch.
Really nice. And so since growing the team to five through the acquisition and then again the premises, you then grew it further. So how did that happen? Was that a slow process? Was there another acquisition? How did you end up with eight?
So a combination of those two things, actually. So when my dad decided to retire from his consulting practice, the obvious thing was for him to sell it to me. And so I bought that practice as well. And I took on his one team member that he had. So he ran a very boutique type of business. And he had a really great assistant who could do lots of bookkeeping, payroll, lots of those kind of extra skills that we needed in the business. So we took her on, and she's a remote worker. So she works down from Andover, which is about an hour from us. And she dials into our team meetings online. So we use technology to really keep in contact as much as we can. And then the rest of it was through recruiting. So we went out and looked for great members of staff to do the delivery of the work that we do. So that's the meeting with clients face to face, doing the year end accounts, and also bringing on some bookkeeping staff to do some of that day to day work that's required. So we went and recruited, and we built the team. I'd say not, it wasn't crazily fast, but we did bring on three members of accounting staff all in 1 year, probably too many in hindsight, because it takes quite a lot of management to bring those through. And we now just have two of those three members of staff with us. And I think we've settled into just about the right size of team for the way I like to work, because it means we still all know everybody's client base. We all know each other very well, and we can work together really well. And we're not in a position where we know clients by their numbers. We still know them by their names, who their kids are, what sort of job they do. And that's a really nice place for me. That's the sort of business I like to be involved in.
Really nice. And so once you sort of brought on those other members, you mentioned that you've got one working remotely. How's that changed things? Because lots of businesses are either fall into the camps of either you have one, everyone in the office, or you go completely remote, which is what I do with my software business, for example. Mm-hmm. And then you've kind of got the option of having the hybrid. And often there's kind of, benefits and disadvantages, but there's quite a few challenges of kind of operating both. So how does that work for you? And does it now work that you've got five in the office and then three that are remote, or is it seven and one? How's it split, and how do you make it work?
Yeah, so it's seven and one. So the majority of people come to the office every day. But we happen to be an all-female team. And along with, I think one of the reasons that we're like that is because we've always said we're very open to flexible working. So we have some people that work term time only from the office, and then in the holidays they kind of pick and choose their own hours and work around their kids, and that's fine. I'm absolutely relaxed about that. And the accounting profession now, you really can work from just about anywhere. We do all of our work, all of our accounting work in the cloud, all of our CRM system is in the cloud, so I can take my laptop and work from wherever I need to be. We deal with clients who aren't close by to us physically over Zoom, and we do that for quite a few people. Our furthest client away is in Australia. So we let tech really help us with that. And Natalie's our only remote, properly remote worker, but it's really not an issue at all. I think the thing that we do have to we work hard to keep an eye on is that when people aren't in the office, they don't feel cut off. So we try to make sure that our lines of communication are really open. We use a WhatsApp group for a more kind of for the more casual interactions. So, you know, we'll ping up little messages to one another that way. And that kind of helps to keep the sense of team still there, even though we're not always in the same physical space.
Great. And so to sort of go further on that, so how do you kind of keep team spirits high when, you know, particularly when you're not able to physically be with them? Because, you know, bringing the charisma and the enthusiasm can be a bit more difficult as soon as you're remote. So and particularly, you know, a WhatsApp message isn't going to quite do it. So how do you keep the energy and support that when across those boundaries?
Yeah, so we do a few things. We try to make sure that we have a couple of proper big socials during the year. So we did a big old Christmas party just before we finished the week before Christmas. So we try and make sure that there are things that are done outside of the office. And then we do, so last year, our kind of social bit we try to do about once a month is a games night here in the office. So we get together, bring our board games, have a couple of drinks, and just let our hair down a little bit. And I think it's really important that we do stuff that means we get to know each other, not just as accountants, but the other things that are going on in our lives, and become really aware of what other pressures there might be going on outside of the accounting world that we inhabit during the working day, so that we can better support each other. And I think as a team, we're really good at listening to each other and sort of filling in where people are maybe struggling at home. So we can say, look, don't stay late tonight. I'll cover this bit for you. So we work on that kind of stuff. We try to keep that kind of energy going by there's this amazing accounting conference called ZeroCon, and Zero is a big bit of software that people are more and more aware of, mm-hmm. that we use with all our clients. And ZeroCon happens once a year. We go up to London, we all stay up there for a night, and we spend a couple of days just really talking strategy and where we're going to go with the business and what new tech we can bring back and share with our clients. And doing those kind of away days, they really help with that team bonding experience.
Nice. And I think it's really interesting where you look at the power and the importance of that direct social time. I think you're so right that it's important to spend time learning about each other outside of work, and often in person can be so powerful for that. So I think that sounds like a really good setup. How do you make it work for, particularly where you've got the flexible working times? Because, you know, I love that you support the flexible working, and indeed, you know, my software business, that's something that we're really keen on too. And indeed, we even advertise our roles, like the title is often described as family friendly, like as in the in the job title, like family friendly, full stack developer, for example, is a role that we've got currently recruiting into. And it's but how do you make that work? Because I mean, you've specifically provided an example there of people working during term times and then not at others. How do you make that work then for the business to kind of balance your workload, because, you know, people's availability might not necessarily map to people's accounting periods, I guess. So how do you kind of make that work?
Yeah, it's tricky. We've learned and we've tweaked and we're getting better at it, I think. A lot of it comes down to just being really frank and open with one another. So we have a sit down on a Monday and on a Friday. And on that Monday, one of the questions we ask is, what's your workload like? How are you feeling about it? Because actually what your workload is like and what you're feeling might not be the same. They might not be on the same scale. You know, sometimes somebody's got a big ton of work, but they're really nailing it. And other times there's not a crazy amount of work, but they're not really feeling they're coping. So no, we have those kind of conversations. We'll talk about how we can support each other, who can fit in and pull things off somebody's list and share it across. So there's a lot of that goes on. And we also plan ahead a lot. So summer holidays are always going to happen. We know they're coming. We've all got children to work around, different school holidays. So we make some plans nice and early, and we say, right, we're going to have this black spot here where we won't have any bookkeepers for 2 weeks, for example. And then we communicate back with clients and we say, so we know your VAT quarter is going to end during this period. So we're either going to make sure that we get your work done way before it, or you're going to have a different cover for that a particular month. But normally we can manage our workflow to work around those kind of holidays by communicating really clearly with the clients about what to expect. And outside of the very short deadlines, which are normally around payroll, the shortest deadline we have is a week. We have sort of a weekly turnaround for some payrolls. But outside of that, for accounting, you've got 9 months to get your accounts done. So you can plan around that kind of stuff quite well. It's just about being really, really open with what's coming up and making sure that you look ahead.
Fantastic. Love it. And in terms of the team that you've then got, how much do you think you've kind of recruited and brought in people with the skills and experience already versus how much training have you then done of your team to kind of get them to be able to do it? You know, do you have very standard processes for how things are delivered and therefore it's about training the team and using that, or is it about building their skills and then they choose how to do it? How do you kind of strike that balance?
Okay, so recruiting, I always recruit for attitude over skills. So we've tended to have people coming in with still some training that they need to do. I've got two members of staff at the moment who are on apprentice type of training for their full accounting qualifications. So that's for ACCA. And they're not, you wouldn't walk in and say they're clearly apprentices, that they're people that aren't in the sort of first bit of their training. But the apprentice schemes are amazing for our type of skills that you need for accounting. So I've got one lady who is, she won't mind me saying, slightly older than late 40s, and she's on one of the apprentice schemes. So it's great for that kind of stuff. When I recruit, I always use an incredible recruiter around here called Jane Johnson from Better People. And she knows the type of people that I'm looking for. She knows the soft skills I need. She knows the sort of way that we interact with our clients because she's also one of my clients. And so when I ask her to recruit for me, she's always looking for the sort of people with a really open, personable, empathetic style. So even if they haven't got exactly the right accounting qualifications that I need, she knows I'll train them for those, but I think it's really hard to change people's attitude. It's much easier to train them to get the right skills. So that's how I go about dealing with that kind of recruitment part of fitting in the team. And I'm sorry, Alex, I can't remember what the rest of the question was.
No, that's a great answer. I love that. And because I think, something that's one of our core values in my software business is that, you know, we're always looking to improve. And I think that as you say, you know, you don't really want people that come in as the, you know, either believing that the finished article or actually being it, because it's far more important to have the values fit, the right attitudes, the belief sets and so on. And then you can kind of build on the skills. Yeah. And I think that's awesome.
I was just going to say, we did a big piece of work last year on nailing down what our core values really are. They've always been a little bit fluffy in the past, and we spent a good few sessions with the whole team getting them really nailed down. So that helps with the recruiting the right sort of people, because we're looking for that value match. But it also really helps when I'm not here in the office. So if the guys in the team are having to make a decision about how to deal with a situation that they might in the past have come and picked up the phone and said, Tori, we don't know what to do here. We've now got these six core values that they can run through and go, well, how do we find the answer that's in alignment with what these core values are? Because we know if we do that, that's what Tori would have wanted. And that's a really helpful tool that we've kind of developed over the last year.
That's really good. I think I've definitely seen that same value over and over and over again at lots of organisations that I've either worked with as a consultant or indeed other entrepreneurs, through my network, through my software business. And it's often underappreciated quite how impactful it can be when done right. I think the problem is the nuance, right? It's so easy to just say, oh yeah, we came up with a list of values. They're around here somewhere on a PowerPoint slide, or I emailed them out to everyone, job done.
There we go.
And of course,
it's finished.
Yeah, that's not how it works. So give us a picture of how have you got to the point that actually your team know the values well enough that they can use them to make decisions? Because that's not a small thing, right? You know, it's hard enough to instill your values enough that anyone in the company can remember all of them, never mind really understand them and use them for decision making. So what's it taken, you know, how's it embedded in the organization? How's it used so that people have that level of understanding?
Yeah, okay. So we actually do a core values workshop here for clients. So where we started from was saying, well, if we're going to run this for clients, we've got to have done it for ourselves first. So we ran through exactly the same process that we would use for clients internally. And then what we've done, so we came up with the headings for what those values were going to be, and then said, well, that's just the beginning. So it's great to have, one of them is build sustainable businesses. So we know that that's one of our core values, but it doesn't really mean anything without an explanation. So we created these six posters of our core values and then broke down what that actually means for us. So like on our build sustainable businesses, we plan for the future. We support clients to build businesses for the long term. We take our environmental impact really seriously. And we believe a healthy, happy workplace is essential for every business. So those are the kind of bits that underline that one core value. We built these posters up that are around the office. So they're scattered around in different rooms. People see them when they're making a cup of tea. And we also, as part of the process, said to the team, you've all got to learn these off by heart and then be able to present them. Because if you don't know them at the drop of a hat, then they're not really embedded in what we're doing. So that's the kind of approach we took. And when I first started talking about it, I was a little bit shy about saying to the staff, I want to do this work on core values. I thought it sounded a little bit woo-woo, and we're accountants, we don't really do woo-woo very much. But it was such a lovely feeling when we started talking about it and people got really enthused, and they're their values, they're not mine. I haven't handed them down, we've built them together. And I think it's that bit where people feel that they were part of that process. It makes them integral to the business.
Awesome. And how do you, because as you say, you built that with the people in the business, but of course, since then, you will add other people. Do you currently have a process of how you kind of onboard new people into those values?
So I haven't had a new starter since we did that bit of work. And it's possible that we won't have one for another 3 or 4 months, I would think. So it's a process that is definitely right at the forefront of my mind, that when we do take somebody on, it has to start from that. And that will even be part of the recruitment process, is making sure that people know what those core values are before they even send us a CV, I would think. But it's going to definitely be an essential part of doing that recruitment going forward.
Perfect. Yeah, I think it's definitely something that I remember when we went through a similar journey at Spidergap, where we kind of first created the values and then you kind of talk about them a bit and then you realise that people can't remember them and you think, well, that's we can't be doing a great job there. And so you take it a bit further and a bit further. And now when I think about it, it's like, well, it's on the advert. So when someone goes and looks at a job advert at Spidergap, it's in any ad for any role with us, they're listed. And then we have questions throughout the recruitment process that specifically relate to those values. And often, particularly in the culture fit interview, we'll signpost like, oh, okay, so one of our core values, or our first core value, is focus on impact. And we, you know, which means we're always asking why we're doing something. And then we ask a question. And then like day one, and then before people join, we then like send out, okay, here's our values and all the detail, you know, the behaviors, et cetera, behind it. And then we discuss it it's one of the first things as part of day one, we then go through the values. We talk about where they feel they're currently at. So they do a kind of bit of self-assessment with their line manager to discuss, you know, where do they feel they're strong and relatively weaker, and therefore what do they want to do about that. And that kind of starts their personal development journey. And I think the more we've used the values, the more we've found it's actually a really effective tool just for anchoring anchoring all of your kind of personal development conversations around. Because you can kind of say, well, okay, you know, or the first aim should be making sure that we're excelling in all our core values before we look at anything else. You know, before you say, all right, let's see if you can be a line manager, or let's see if we can take on a new role. Like, if you're not exhibiting and demonstrating all the values consistently, then that needs to be the starting point. And I think that's that was probably one of the biggest changes, because of course, as soon as you set the expectation, a bit like you did when you say, we're going to set the expectation that you should memorize these and be able to present them. As soon as you set a change in expectation to, you're going to need to be able to self-assess against these, develop your personal development plan against these, you'll be managed against these. It's like, you don't ignore them, right? It's I think that's really nice. And so...
I was just going to say, it also takes out some of that, you know, when you're having a personal conversation about what's working and what's not working with a team member, when you've got these values that have already been agreed between you all and the team's agreed them, then it's really easy to have a conversation that doesn't feel like you're making a personal attack on somebody. You're just saying, well, if we measure against this value that we've all agreed we're going to live up to, and you're not hitting it, then there's something that we can work on together there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, then if you're using them for recruitment, then it means that even if someone wasn't part of the development process, they've been recruited on the basis of those values. And therefore, they are also therefore signed up to them. So yeah, I completely agree. So switching slightly then into the finance sort of aspect of business, because that's for a lot of people can be a very stressful thing. I mean, let's first bottom that out. So based on your experience of working with lots of different small businesses, how stressful can it get for those businesses in terms of managing their finances, and what specifically seems to be the most common causes of stress when we look at sort of business finances?
Yeah, okay. So it's really stressful. It's very interesting how out of control so many business owners feel. They may not be out of control with their financials, but I have multiple conversations in a month with people saying, I don't want to tell anybody else about how bad this is, but I'm really worried about my money situation. I'm really worried about where the business is going. It keeps me up at night. I stress about what the tax bill is going to be. Those kind of conversations are really, we have them really regularly. And we have a bit of a joke in the office that I have a big squishy armchair in my office that's called the crying chair. And people come in and they sit down and they go, it's all going wrong, Tori, help me. And we have a little box of tissues next door to it. And we have a lot of those kind of conversations. Running a business is stressful. And I think I work with a lot of female entrepreneurs and business owners, and there's definitely a block for a lot of women about, I don't do numbers, I don't understand figures very well, I really feel I'm being put on the spot if people ask me about my figures. And I think there's a bit of that sort of dragon's den fear that people have, you know, when they say, do you know your finances? And you absolutely freeze up. And I see that happen to lots of my business owners. So we spend lots of time working on confidence around numbers, knowing what those metrics are that you need to measure, and knowing what you don't need to worry about so much, and giving people the confidence that they really can run their business by knowing their numbers, is one of my sort of key aims from what we do here in Panthera, is to make sure that people don't have that horrible stress of, I don't know what my VAT bill is going to be, I don't know how much money I should have put away for corporation tax, I don't know if my margins are right. Those kind of conversations are ones we have an awful lot. And I think one of the definitely now, and I think it's probably getting worse, is one of the major stresses is this dealing with HMRC, dealing with tax, and the way that HMRC communicates with people just at the moment feels pretty unfriendly, I think. I know they're trying really hard to get rid of that persona of the tax man being a scary person that you can't talk to. But the way that they write to clients, the way that they let people know what's expected, can be really quite harsh. And I've seen a few clients right on the edge with their mental health from the way that HMRC have dealt with either incorrect figures that they're saying you owe us this money and it's not right, or chasing people whose relatives have died, maybe somebody that's involved in their business has passed away, and the way that they deal with that isn't always very sensitive.
Yeah, and I can understand how when that's happening, particularly if you've got it's kind of two things happening at the same time there, isn't it? You've got, in the case of the relative one, that's obvious. It's, you know, you've got the issues relating to both the emotional side and the business difficulties mm-hmm. of losing a key member, plus then getting the pressure from the tax agency. I guess the same goes for any aspect. You know, if you, like, if your numbers are wrong, it won't have been, hopefully, it won't have been an intentional inaccuracy. And frankly, even if it was, I suspect it will have been motivated by some other pressure. And so then you're kind of getting it at both sides, aren't you? It's both you feel out of control with your finances and like you haven't got a clear position, and you've got the tax agency making you feel stupid and like a criminal kind of straight out the gate. And so, yeah, so I can understand how that'd be painful and particularly stressful. What are some of the things that you found most useful for business owners in terms of kind of reducing the stress or making finances just generally less stressful?
I think what's happened over the last, let's say, 6-7 years with the move over into cloud accounting is amazing for business owners. So if you're well guided, I think it could be incredibly low stress running a business as long as you're using those tools correctly. So things like Xero means that you don't have to wait anymore for your year-end accounts that your accountants have prepared, and they'll tell you about it. What, maybe up to sort of 15 or 16 months after the event, you can know what your business is doing today, right up to date. And that's because all of the cloud accounting platforms now will pull data from your bank up to yesterday's data, probably. And if you stay on top of that, then you never need to be in a position where you don't know what the tax bill is going to be. You don't know how much you owe to people. So in some ways, we're in the best time ever for having a really clear view of what's going on with your finances in your business. It's just using that technology correctly. And I guess the downside is that we've got so much information being thrown at us these days that it's hard sometimes to pick out the stuff that you need from the stuff that you don't need so much. So I guess my biggest tip for people who are feeling a bit out of control with their finances is start with the basics, which is getting your day-to-day bookkeeping right. And from that, everything flows. So, it's the same with all kind of processes, that if you put rubbish in, you get rubbish out. And if you put lovely clean data in, you're going to get lovely clean data out, and you can do something with that. So start on the small stuff, make sure that your bookkeeping's right. From there, you get your VAT right, which is probably one of the things that scares most people. And once you're getting all that stuff right, knowing how you've done over the last month, quarter, year compared to the year before or the period before is really quick and easy, and you should be able to get that data within 10 to 15 minutes. It should not be taking a day to get your data at the end of the month. And once you've got that coming to you, then you can make decisions, because you can see what's happening in your business, and you can also be aware of any potential holes that are coming up, for example, in your cash flow. So you may be running a really profitable business, but you're growing really fast, and suddenly 3 months down the line, you're going to have a hole in your cash flow because you're spending out on things you're going to need to continue that growth. You should be able to see that coming. And if you don't think you can see that coming, you've got the wrong advisor.
Yeah, I think that all of that's great advice and things that, definitely for my businesses, I've found such a step change when I've put in the proper, as you say, the proper processes that mean it's not a headache, that mean that you can be on top of it. You know, one of the highlights for me in my business was when I set up a process for daily bank reconciliations that is now done by a member of my team and not by me. It means that, you know, any new weird payments or whatever, they get captured as issues, and then we just work out what should be the new rule or the process step or whatever. And as you say, it just means that you've constantly got brilliantly up-to-date data, and if there's anything weird in there, you can follow it backwards and work out what was the rule or decision that you made ages ago that you need to tweak or whatever and fix. And I think it's amazing, isn't it? When you start with some of the basics, you'll learn as soon as you start accepting that this is stuff you need to learn, particularly as you grow, that you sort of get that foundation learning in, and then it just comes, doesn't it? As you go further and further and further through it, and you start thinking, oh, okay, well, actually, what would be really useful is if I could, for example, group some of these account lines in my profit and loss so that I can see like total salaries, or I can split out by team because I want to give some of my management team budget line ownership or whatever. And that all comes like later on if you've got your basics in place and you're coding things in an appropriate way and you understand how it's working. Yeah, so I think that's absolutely really, really great advice. In terms of like cash flow management, you know, one of the problems often, you know, with accounting and bookkeeping tools is that they tend to focus on the past and what's happened rather than what's happening in the future. How do you and your clients kind of manage the cash flow side and making sure that you've got good visibility of that? Because that's not always, it's not easy to have predictive figures, whereas to get that sense.
Yeah, it's probably the hole right now in sort of small business accounting. So I think we've pretty much nailed how do you get the data in, how do you match up with your bank, and how can you see really quickly what your P&L for the last month is. Xero are working really hard on a cash flow forecast within the product, and that'll just be probably looking forward for a month at the moment, and that works off a bit of so it uses some AI to see what you've done in the past, and it looks at some of the data that you've put in, and that probably won't arrive. I think it's probably going to come out in the next 6 months or so. So there's definitely a focus within the industry that this is a problem and a hole that we do need to fix. But for more further forward cash flow forecasting than that, we use a tool called Spotlight, which is one of our forecasting tools. And we suck data out of Xero, make some assumptions in the Spotlight tool that says stuff like, our clients usually pay us within 45 days. We normally pay our bills within 30 days. We've borrowed some money from Funding Circle, for example, and the payment schedule looks like this. And we put all of that data into the software, and it pumps out a cash flow forecast at the end. And then we can just tweak all of those assumptions with the client. So the cash flow forecasting tools are out there. They tend to be in the hands of accountants. There are other tools like Fluidly, for example, and they're available to small business users, and they're becoming so much more accessible because the cost of this kind of software is coming down. When I first started training, you could only really do that kind of work with a big team of management accountants, some really expensive bespoke software, and as a small business, if you wanted to know what your cash flow forecast was, you probably sat down with Excel and typed in where you were going to spend money over the next few months. You don't have to do it that way anymore. There are many more options for it. But I kind of think of cash flow forecasting as the next step. So clean up your data, get your you get your reporting right, and then off the back of your reporting, you start to build your cash flow forecasts. And that's the kind of place that, in my ideal world, all of my clients would be able to get their hands on that kind of data really quickly, so they can then say, right, and therefore we need some funding in April next year, and then they come back to me and we've got nice contacts that can go out to the whole of the market and say, look, we need some funding for this business for this amount of time. What are you going to come back to me with? And then I can go back to the client and say, look, here are all of your options.
Nice. That's really good. And I've seen from other entrepreneurs that I've had contact with over the years that cash flow can cause so much stress. I mean, we've talked about the taxes and working and calculating them and so on. But one of the big pieces of advice I've often given is, you know, provisioning, like putting aside money when you earn it rather than when you owe it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you work out that over the last month you made 20 grand in profit or whatever, then work out what's the tax that you're going to need to pay on that, and corporation tax, and put that aside in a separate account, and, you know, put aside your VAT and so on, and found that that's massively reduced personal stress, even if it means that, you know, you end up with a load of bank accounts, a load of cash in them that doesn't do anything. It does feel pretty good. You know, in terms of on that mental health side, I mean, I know that You yourself had a, I believe it was a panic attack on a flight a few years ago, brought on by kind of work stress and so on.
Yeah.
You know, mental health is often not just, you know, not related to specific things like a sudden tax bill that you weren't expecting, or whatever. It can just kind of mount up. You know, what's kind of been your experience of that kind of work stress? How have you changed your working practices so that you keep your mental health in check? You know, what are the kind of day to day working patterns that you use to kind of support your well-being?
Yeah. Okay. So that particular episode happened when I was off on just the most wonderful family holiday. We were having the time of our lives. We've gone over to Disneyland and we were doing America. And I found myself on a plane realizing it was Thursday. And Thursday, for the last 10 years, I've written a set of weekly reports for a client, very good client, every single Thursday. And I suddenly realized with the time difference that I had, because I was in the States, I wasn't going to get these reports done on time. And I'm a pretty low stress type of person from the outside. People that know me think I'm pretty calm. Nothing really shakes me. But that was enough. It just built up and built up over a flight. And I ended up being taken off the flight as we landed in an ambulance. It was a mess. It was embarrassing for the children. It was embarrassing for everybody else. And I scared everybody, actually. And I scared myself. So I'd realized that I'd allowed stress to build up with me around work to the point that it made me really sick. And I got back to work and I said, that's got to stop. So I cut down my working hours. A few months later, I decided to drop working on a Wednesday. And that's probably the scariest conversation I've ever had at the office. I called all the team together and I said, look, I think this is how I'm going to try and deal with my stress issue. How would you feel if I didn't come in on a Wednesday? And everyone went, yeah, just that sounds obvious, Tori, do that. And I thought that it was going to create an enormous trouble because they felt I wasn't supporting them, or I wasn't available to them as they needed me. And in effect, what it meant was that I was definitely going to be available because I wasn't killing myself with working crazy hours. So that was a big change for me. Working 4 days a week has been a total game changer, because it means I really do a 2 day week and then I have a mini weekend on a Wednesday, and then I have another 2 day week and then I have a proper weekend. So it stops stress building up too much. And it also reminds me that there's a world outside of accounting and clients. And lots of accountants, I think, have the same kind of issue. We really care passionately about our clients, and when things aren't going well for them, we worry about it and we take it on our shoulders. And it's really important to allow some of that stuff to go. So alongside changing my working hours, I started to meditate every morning. So before my day starts at all, before I even see the children, actually, I get straight out of bed, I do my meditation, and then my day starts. So I'm in a much better mental space on a daily basis. I spend lots of time on working on my mindset, doing my personal development, and I'm a member of a group that supports entrepreneurs called BBB Mastermind. And BBB stands for Bigger, Brighter, Bolder, and we're a whole group of people who run their own businesses and want to support each other, specifically around our mindsets and making sure that we're looking after ourselves and growing our businesses in a healthy way. I exercise. I have things that go on outside of the office. So I was telling you a little bit earlier that I really love to go and watch live music as one of my sort of outside my accounting world life. So I do that about once a week. I go to a gig and just let my hair down. And I try as much as I can to shut the laptop when I'm at home and let work stay in its box. But all of those changes have they've been difficult, but they've been really, really rewarding. And I really think that that's an important thing to be aware of as a business owner, that your business isn't absolutely everything, and it's really important to make sure you've got space for outside life.
Love it. Fantastic advice. And those are things that I've seen I've seen entrepreneurs, including myself, that would tend to think of themselves as you said earlier, like not woo woo and very down to earth and pragmatic and scientific and so on. And yet, the power of exercise and meditation and those sorts of things can just it's just amazing. And I love the other advice you gave around managing your time and so on. I think that's absolutely fantastic. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. I really appreciate your time. It's been awesome talking to you and hearing about the amazing success that you've had in building your team and how you manage the day-to-day as well. Thank you so much. Before we end, how can people kind of make contact with you and reach out if they'd like to kind of learn more about what Panthera Accounting does and yourself?
Yeah, so you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, website. We're at Panthera Accounting. I'm quite easy to find online because my name is Tori Wagg and I'm the only one in this country, at least. So it's TORYWAGG. And you'll find me on Instagram mostly doing fitness. You'll find me on Twitter mostly talking about heavy metal music. And you'll find me in Facebook in the real world being a mum.
Fantastic. Love it. And fantastic. Well, I'll also make sure that we've got links to everything that we've discussed in the show notes as well. But thank you again. Really appreciate your time. And I hope you have a fantastic rest of your week.
Thank you so much, Alexis. It's been really fun talking to you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and have taken away some ideas that you can put into practice. You can find the links to any resources mentioned in this episode over on the show notes at parentpreneur.com/podcast. If you found this podcast useful, then please review it on iTunes. 5-star review ratings would absolutely make my day. Also, please join the conversation on this episode. Just head over to the Parentpreneur Accelerator community on Facebook, where you'll find other parentpreneurs that are sharing their experiences and helping each other to succeed. To find the group, just visit parentpreneur.com/community. Thanks very much.